I'm Mona Sinha. I am currently the chairperson of Women Moving Millions, and I'm a great advocate for gender equality. My mission in life is to make sure that women get the opportunities they deserve and make the best changes they can in our world. Celebrate, you know, you're there for a reason, you bring something to the party. Often I'd be requested to work on a deal by a CEO because they found me interesting, because perhaps I had stories that they hadn't heard. So step into it and own it and celebrate and be who you authentically are.
This is Secrets of Wealthy Women from the Wall Street Journal, helping women empower themselves financially. Now, Veronica Dagger.
Mona Sinha is a philanthropist and board member of Women Moving Millions. She speaks about the importance of giving back and why women need to help each other.
So Mona, as a young woman in India, you volunteered with Mother Teresa. What did you learn from her?
Mother Teresa was a truly inspiring woman. Everybody who grew up in Calcutta knew her because she was so ever-present on the streets and in the work that she did with the most vulnerable populations of the city. What I learned from her really was that not everybody can do great things, but everybody can do small things with a lot of love, and that can change lives around you. And I've carried that message with me throughout my life.
It's amazing. You said you were more like a guy, or that you're just more like a guy in general. What do you mean by that?
Well, I grew up as the third daughter in a fairly conservative Bengali family, and I think in that situation, you know, being the third girl wasn't a really great place to be because of all the male preference that exists even today in countries like India. So as a third girl, I was always questioned about, oh, you don't have a brother. Oh, your parents don't have a son. And then there was a clicking of the tongues and the sort of sympathetic pauses that followed. And so I felt this great burden to be the boy. I felt like this was my parents' last chance, and I blew it without really having a choice, right? So I think for a large part of my growing up life, I tried to compensate and be the boy. So I played the sports, even though I was terrible at it. And I had to do well in school because that's what the son would have done. And I had to sort of, you know, be the protector in the family, even though ironically I was the youngest child. So I did grow up feeling that burden and feeling that pressure of having not been a boy.
What did your mom think of you being more like a boy?
You know, I think she had mixed feelings. I think even today, sometimes she says, I wish I'd had a boy, which is a little hurtful. But yeah. I'm in a place now where I can actually gently correct her and say, well, you know, the boy may have married someone that you didn't like, and then what would happen?
So, very true.
So, I think that she sometimes fell prey to the pressure around her without really meaning to. But
what do you say to women who have mothers who may have different expectations for them or kind of say hurtful things like that?
I think you have to create your own support systems, and that's a lesson I learned pretty early on. I think you have to learn how to be confident in who you are and how to support yourself in that mission of finding out who you really are.
How do you find those support systems?
Mentors, teachers, often, very often, teachers are our early mentors. And then as you get older in life, people who you meet who share the same values, people in the workplace, you know, there are people more like you everywhere than not. And it's just a matter of being able to connect with people and keeping those relationships alive.
How much of it is also trying to change your parents, or is that a mistake?
I think that's very hard. I think it's very hard. I mean, you know, half a century later, my mom still says some of those things. And it's not my job to change her. It's my job to sort of, you know, show her who I am and who I've become as a fully fledged woman. And that I did compete in a man's world, but I competed on my own terms. And then that's fine. And that my daughters don't have to have that same pressure. And they're fine being who they are.
So your first job was on Wall Street and in investment banking, and you were often the only brown woman in the room. What did that feel like?
To be honest, I didn't really think of it. You know, it's interesting because today people say, oh, you're a woman of color. Yes, I am, but I never knew that growing up in India because everybody looked like me. So I think only when moving to America made me realize that I was different. I grew up fairly competitive, just trying to be a boy when I wasn't, and then trying to succeed at school when I was all by myself. And so the competitive piece of being on Wall Street actually quite excited me. And I loved my work. I loved being good at what I did. And sometimes it took me by surprise when somebody pointed out that I was different. But you know, I sort of accepted that. And I'm joyous in that other people sometimes tell me that I broke the stereotype so other people could be there after me.
What do you say to women who do notice that they are the only woman in the room? Like, how do they not feel intimidated and keep confident?
I think celebrate. You know, you're there for a reason. You bring something to the party. Often I'd be requested to work on a deal by a CEO because they found me interesting, because perhaps I had stories that they hadn't heard. So step into it and own it and celebrate and be who you authentically are.
You said you initially got some less high-profile assignments when you were starting out because you were a woman. What advice would you give to women who find themselves in that situation?
Well, in my situation, you know, I graduated from a liberal arts college, and I had a degree in economics, but I was not a finance geek, you know, by any definition. And I was competing with, you know, the guys who graduated from Wharton, from other business schools who knew this stuff backwards and in their dreams. In my situation, I really buckled down and said, I have to learn this stuff. If I'm going to be good at this job, I have to be just as good as everybody else. And I think the determination and the willpower really saw me through this. I would spend hours at night working on models, understanding what the little pivots were that could change a DCF analysis or a valuation analysis, you know. And to this day, I remember those days. I remember those little tricks, and I remember those, you know, things that I did at 3 a.m., you know, trying to make sure that I knew what I had to know really well. And I think that I didn't shy away from taking on the assignments that I was initially given. But what I did do is perform on them to a degree that was vastly greater than what was expected. And that gets you noticed. I think when you do really good work, you do your homework, you know what you're talking about, and you're prepared. And people turn to you to ask the questions when they're not sure, you know, what the answers are. That's when you get noticed.
You worked on a big merger, I'm sure many big mergers, but at one point a senior banker tried to blame you for a mistake he made, and you were trying to decide what to do. Can you tell us about that?
That was a pretty pivotal moment. I think there always come moments in our lives where we're ready to either quit or we're ready to say, okay, I'm not going to deal with this. And that was one of those moments. We were actually working on a very big merger. There were changes happening at the last minute. There was a big meeting scheduled for the next day. And so the senior banker decided he was going to help me, which I thought was wonderful. But as he was playing around with the model, which I'm sure he hadn't done in a long time, he made a mistake. And in my naivete, I didn't check his work, thinking, of course, he's the senior banker. He knows what he's doing. And so when I was invited to sit in the meeting and they're talking about the numbers, my heart literally stopped because I realized that there was a mistake that he had made in his calculations. And they were basing the discussions off of that mistake. It was one of those moments where you're like, oh, my God, do I just be quiet and let them go on?
Yeah.
But I raised my hand and I pointed it out and the conversation flowed. But I knew there'd be a repercussion. And sure enough, the head of the department called us in, even though the deal actually went through, and sort of, you know, in banking terms, reamed us out because of what had happened in front of a client. And the banker who was there was quiet and didn't say anything. And sort of the blame was placed on my shoulders as a person who traditionally ran the models. So I sat with it for a bit and I left the office. Everybody was popping champagne and celebrating. And I went home and I came back the next day and I went into his office and I said, you know, you need to fess up because this is the start of my career and this will take me down. And initially, he tried to underplay it. Oh, it's done. We're celebrating. It's such a big deal. It's wonderful. You did great work. And I kind of dug my heels in, and I said, no, I'm not going to take that. I said, you need to own up to this. And I think he realized that I was pretty serious about it. Maybe he was a little afraid that I'd go, you know, say something myself. But kudos to him. He did actually go and tell the senior banker that it was not my fault, and an apology ensued, and all was good. But I felt proud for standing up for myself.
How did you get the confidence to do that at what, like 23 or however you were?
Yeah, I think it was just a sheer outrage. I think I take great pride in my work, in anything I do. And just to be blamed for something that I didn't do. And my question was, why should I take it? Why should I take somebody else's blame? And I think part of that chutzpah, which is a word I love, comes from sort of my own life journey and having to defend myself in many instances.
What do you say to women who are trying to decide whether or not they should take the blame for someone's mistake or take that gamble, frankly, and speak up?
I think you decide on what the consequences are. There are some things you let go, as we all do as women, and there are some things you don't. And I think where it's something that's high profile and you know that people are going to be talking about it, I could sort of envision looking into the future and saying, oh, remember that big deal? Oh, my God, it almost didn't happen because, you know, so-and-so made that mistake. And I wasn't going to let that happen because it wasn't my mistake to own.
Coming up, Mona Sinha explains how women can come together to create change.
Robert Half research indicates 9 out of 10 hiring managers are having difficulty hiring. Robert Half is here to help. Our recruiting professionals utilize our proprietary AI to connect businesses with highly skilled talent. At Robert Half, we know talent. Visit roberthalf.com today.
You're listening to Secrets of Wealthy Women from the Wall Street Journal.
Both you and your husband worked long hours while you were raising your kids, and you said if you weren't always there for them, you didn't feel guilty. What do you explain?
I think kids are resilient. I think as women, whatever role we play in their lives, have to inspire them to be their best selves. For my kids, seeing that I've been involved in work outside the home, not just on Wall Street, but outside in my philanthropy and in other volunteer work that I do, has inspired them. It's interesting because my twin daughters are now applying to college. And I was reading one of my daughter's Common App essays, and she talks very casually about listening to my mother's mentees around the kitchen table.
Aww.
And I loved reading
That's
that
great.
Because obviously it does impact their lives in ways that we don't always see.
That's really neat. So some people say it's still very difficult to be a woman in business. What do you think and what do you hear from your mentees?
I think women have made great strides. I think from the 80s and 90s when I worked in the business world, changes have happened. People have spoken up courageously. Things like the Me Too movement have, you know, channeled the energy of women to be recognized and be appreciated for what they bring to the table, including their diversity, including their thought processes, including their very, you know, powerful skills of collaboration and negotiation. But I think women get the greatest power from each other. I think to have a strong, supportive network of women, whether in the workforce or outside, is important for everyone.
So you mentor countless women, as you mentioned. What's the biggest mistake you see women who are seeking mentoring make?
Giving up. I think it's easy to give up. I think often women think, well, maybe I'm not good enough. I have that self-doubt, and so I should go for option B. And I always counsel them and say, no, absolutely not. Not unless you've really given option A the biggest kick you can possibly give it.
But what do you say? Like, you know, sometimes it just gets really tough. Like, how do you know that if it's time to actually leave?
You know when it's time to leave. I think all of us have that inner radar which tells us enough is enough. And I think what's important, though, is when you feel that feeling is to explore what other options are out there and not give up completely on a career. I mean, there's so many choices women have these days. There's flexibility in working from home. There's flexibility in timing. There's flexibility on just careers themselves. So speak to as many people as you can. Get as much advice as you can. Seek out as much information as you can before making that choice.
You're the board chair of Women Moving Millions, a nonprofit that encourages women to donate large sums of money to charities that benefit women and girls. So which women's issue are funders most concerned about these days?
It really runs the gamut. I think our broad spectrum is, and our vision is to have a gender equal world, which we know is really a vision and may not be realized in my lifetime. The issues that most of our participants, and I really call them catalysts because they catalyze resources in a way that they have never been done before, range from politics, education, health, human rights, trafficking. It really runs the gamut. But in every area where women suffer the most, even an issue like climate change, which is really painted in broad strokes, when you look at it, the people who suffer the most from climate change are women.
What's your advice for women who want to become philanthropists?
Lean in. Just do it. I think often women are scared of the term. Like feminist, philanthropist is one of those labels that women don't identify with very comfortably. But I think in this case, it's wise to step into that discomfort and say, I can do this. You know, I am lucky enough to be in a position where I can do this and I can support other women and lift up women, because the fundamental belief is that women are the agents of change. As women, we strongly want to leave behind a better world for our kids, our grandkids, and so forth. And I think if we entrust women to shape the direction of the world, then it's going to be in much better shape than it is in right now.
You won the Ellis Island Medal of Honor for your contributions to America. What advice would you give to immigrants these days?
It's a tough world there. It's, I think, to tell their stories, and I know that's a hard thing to do when you're fighting for food and water and basic sustenance. I think when you meet immigrants face to face, you're blown away by their stories. Immigrants aren't running away. Immigrants are leaving a country that they deeply love, that they have grown up in, that they have roots in. And they're forced to go somewhere else because of circumstances that are largely out of their control. So I would encourage immigrants to stay the course, know that there are good people out there. It's hard not to be disillusioned, but really, you know, stick the course, meet the people who love you, meet the people who are willing to give you a second chance. And really be mindful of the huge steps that you've already taken.
How can women not be afraid to dream big?
Women must dream big. I think women have dreamt big for decades. I think women are the agents of change. Women can make the world a better place. And when a group of women get together, that's an unstoppable force. So I think women should never be afraid to dream big.
So you mentioned sometimes women don't necessarily feel comfortable with their wealth and their success. So what's maybe one step we could take today to feel more comfortable and sort of own that success?
I think part of it is a cultural thing. You know, growing up in India, I was always told, be very quiet, you know, don't. And this is the piece I was talking about where women don't celebrate their success. Breaking barriers and being wealthy or even inheriting wealth is a wonderful thing because you can share that and you can change other people's lives. Wealth for wealth accumulation is not something most women do. And I think that's something that women need to recognize, that once you make a shift in somebody else's life because you've been able to share something that you own, that's life-changing. And I think anyone who's done that will never steer away from doing it again.
What's the best personal finance advice you ever received?
Know what's in that bank account and know what it's doing every day.
So do you monitor your bank account daily?
I don't monitor it every day, but I certainly watch the news. I certainly look at what's going on in the financial markets. I have a natural interest to that. I make equal decisions with my spouse about our investments and about our philanthropic giving. So being an equal partner in those decisions is very important to me.
What type of investor are you?
I'm foraying into impact investing, which is really investing in areas that have more than just one form of return. It's typically called a triple bottom line because it sometimes has a social return as well as an environmental return in addition to a financial return. That's an area that we're really expanding in our portfolio right now. Other than that, because we are in the finance world, we're not really allowed to invest in stocks and so forth. So we invest in mostly more conservative instruments such as mutual funds and things like that.
So with the impact investments, how do you figure out, you know, what's a good investment or not? Because those aren't necessarily always so transparent.
There's much more information out there than used to be. I think the markets are developing. As with every investment you make, you do your due diligence. You meet the people. You look at the market. You look at the competitors. And you make an informed decision. And frankly, some work and some don't. I think the one thing I would leave with you is that women are strong in this bond that they share together in many different ways. In no way, though, am I suggesting that we leave men out of the picture. I think men can be equal partners and very supportive on this journey to gender equity. And I've had certainly mentors that have been men and have been wonderful supporters. So let's not leave them out of the dialogue.
Time now for your secrets.
I'm Mona Sinha, and my money secret is I give away 15% a month to a deserving charity or a young woman that has no idea it's coming her way.
Be sure to check out our ebook based on the Secrets podcast. WSJ subscribers can download their copy of Resilience, How 20 Ambitious Women Use Obstacles to Fuel Their Success, for free on WSJ.com today. This episode was produced by Tanya Bustos. I'm Veronica Dagger. Thanks for listening.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.